And to me, this summarises what it's all about. Those days, those hours, those minutes, those seconds to Copenhagen are basically the last chance we have, our generation have, to prove whether we are stupid or not stupid. And by that time, by the time that reaches naught, we're going to have that answer. Are we stupid or are we not stupid?
Welcome to the 300 to 350 show, kicking off there with Franny Armstrong starting her countdown to Copenhagen clock at the launch of the must-see drama doc The Age of Stupid back in March. The clock has been steadily ticking ever since, and we've now reached a fairly significant milestone on the road to Copenhagen, as nearly 200 member states meet in Bonn to start working on the first drafts of the Copenhagen texts. Rich countries have been coming forward saying what kind of targets they'd be prepared to commit to, but the offers on the table so far are depressingly inadequate and incompatible with avoiding dangerous climate change. China's suggestion that developed nations make a 40% cut in greenhouse gas emissions by 2020 is the kind of ambition that the twin principles of science and fairness demand. Japan is due to announce its pledge on the 10th of June, and their pitch will play an important role in the success or otherwise of these talks. Here's Misako Kenichi of WWF Japan, Julie Ann Richards of Oxfam Australia, and Faye Tebby of the South Pacific Conference of Churches speaking at the Climate Action Network's press briefing on the 2nd of June in Bonn.
Currently, the Japanese midterm target is the focus of a discussion in Japan. Just to be precise, this midterm means 2020 target compared to 1990 levels. Currently, Japanese government is considering six options ranging from +4% to -25%. But the main industry association, Keidanren, is fiercely lobbying for the weakest target, which is +4%. And they virtually dominated five public hearings that took place in Japan in May and April in saying that the general public in Japan don't want to have strong target. But is it really? The recently completed survey revealed that actually Japanese voters favor for a 25% target or even higher. This survey is conducted a very renowned polling firm, Greensburg Quinlan Rosner. It says 63% Japanese favor for a 25% target or higher, and 62% say ASO is not doing well enough for combating climate change. And 61% believe ambitious 2020 target will actually help the Japanese economy. So the public do want to have strong target. In order to highlight this poll result, we put the ad on Nikkei newspaper, which is a Japanese prestigious business paper, this manga character. Because Aso is known as a very enthusiastic manga lover. So we put Aso in a robot, and he is combating two crises, which is climate crisis and financial crisis, and he is using his best available weapon, which is -25%. So scientists around the world calling for a 25% to 40% target for industrialized countries. If ASO ever to choose weak target, such as -7%, then it is either pressured by industries or willing to please industries and abandon the people's life all around the world. Japan is a country where Kyoto Protocol was born, but it will become a country to kill Copenhagen Protocol. So, ASO is expected to announce its target next week, possibly June 10th. We call for Prime Minister ASO to be a hero like this manga character and combat climate change by setting a target higher than 25%. The world is watching Japan.
Japan negotiates here as part of the umbrella group of countries. Those countries include the US, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, Iceland, Norway, Russia, and the Ukraine. Those countries talk every day, sometimes more than once a day, about their negotiating processes, and Japan will have an influence. Japan's target announcement will have an influence over the other umbrella group countries. It's crucial for that group of countries and for the overall climate negotiations that Japan announces a strong target, at least 25%, in order to drive the level of ambition of the rest of the umbrella group countries into the area that we need. For a long time, we've been used to the umbrella group countries not necessarily playing a positive role in the negotiations. Particularly the US and Australia were the two countries who refused to ratify the Kyoto Protocol. Under previous administrations, we now have new administrations in both of those countries. If we look at the Obama administration in the US, they swept to power with a mandate for change, and the Democrats gained more power in the Congress. Unfortunately, after years and nearly a decade of dissembling by President Bush, there was a huge task for President Obama when he came into power. He has taken a number of very positive steps in the very short period of time that he's had available to him, things that were unthinkable only a year ago. Unfortunately, because of the space we find ourselves in climate change, President Obama needs to increase his level of ambition in order to meet the science and in order to help us prevent dangerous climate change. And we need the Congress within the US to also increase their level of ambition. We see a number of positive things in the Waxman-Markey bill, but there is time to improve that, and we need Congress to improve that in order for the US to participate actively in preventing dangerous climate change. Briefly, the Rudd government in Australia recently committed to a 25% target, which has bipartisan support. So Australia is essentially a two-party system. Both major parties support 25% target for Australia. That target, however, it's a step in the right direction. It's clearly not enough for Australia's fair contribution to preventing catastrophic climate change. But it comes with a number of conditions attached, which, as they stand now, demand an unreasonable level of action from developing countries. For that 25% target from Australia to contribute to a fair share of the global deal to prevent catastrophic climate change, Australia needs to acknowledge that it must provide support for developing countries to reduce their emissions and to adapt to climate change. Crucially, Australia hasn't acknowledged within its conditions to the 25% target that it will provide that support. If we look at Canada, we've only seen movements in the wrong direction since 2005 when the current government was elected, and recently they abandoned their long-standing Made in Canada inadequate approach to an even weaker position of waiting for the US. So Canada's thumbed its nose at the international community by saying it won't meet its Kyoto Protocol targets, and it set itself the unbelievably weak target of 3% below 1990 levels by 2020. New Zealand hasn't even submitted any numerical medium-term targets and repeatedly pleads for special treatment here. So we need Japan to come to the table with a minimum acceptable target of 25%. We need all developed countries to ensure that they take note of what was agreed in Bali, the Bali Action Plan, which acknowledges the 25 to 40% range for developed countries. Countries existing outside of that range will not help us prevent catastrophic climate change. Japan has an opportunity now to put forward a strong target that will undermine the excuses that other umbrella groups make for weak targets. We need Japan to put forward a strong target and to drive up the level of ambition from the umbrella groups to match the science and to ensure that we avoid catastrophic climate change.
The Pacific Conference of Churches is a fellowship, a group of churches representing 28 member churches from the 14 island countries in the Pacific, covering no less than 70% of the total population of the Pacific region, which is about 8.2 million. What I find interesting is that all these umbrella countries are actually Pacific Rim countries. For the Pacific Conference of Churches, we support the AOC's position, calling for a reduction of no less than 40% of 1990 levels from all developing countries. In the Pacific region, we find ourselves losing our burial sites. We find ourselves losing our beaches, our endemic species. We are even on the point of losing some of our island countries over the next decade or two. Countries like Kiribati, countries like Tuvalu, and many other low-lying islands in the Pacific region. So we are faced with a situation where we are trying our best to do what we can to save our islands and to look at our partners, namely Japan and other developed countries, to do their part as well. Over the last week, the Japanese government gave the Pacific Island countries an aid in proximity of 50 billion yen to do development, amongst other things, to address the vulnerabilities of the Pacific Island countries, and that is addressing the effects of climate change. What's the point of giving 50 billion yen to the Pacific region when you can't and you will not reduce your emissions in your own country? You might as well give us 50 trillion yen, because if you do not reduce your emissions in Japan, we will lose our countries. And for the Pacific Island countries, this is not a matter of semantics and text negotiations. This is a question of survival of our countries and of our region.
Thanks, Alastair from Reuters. How many people on these islands have actually moved because of climate change? Is there any central estimate of the scale of this problem so far?
Thank you for the question. We haven't had the opportunity to research on the number of people having to move. But what we can tell you is that we have noted three major resettlements happening in the Pacific. One, as you know, is the Cataract Islands in Papua New Guinea that have had to move as a result of the salination of the water tables and the islands becoming uninhabitable and swamped by sea level rise. The second is the village of Tengua in Vanuatu that also has had to move inland as a result of sea level rise. We've had villages in Fiji, namely on the island of Moala, that have had to move up on the island because the present village site was uninhabitable. You have a number of situations where islands have disappeared as a result of sea level rise. In the Solomon Islands, we have cases where villages, especially in the western province, two villages have had to move inland because of the sea level rise. But that is a good question, and I think we should follow that up with an actual research as to how many islands have disappeared and how many people are moving.
One new issue rearing its head in the negotiations is the issue of biochar, something which this programme has a special responsibility to look at, since the 300 to 350 show took its name after a scientific paper by James Hansen, which mentions biochar as a possible sequestration technique that we could use to bring the concentration of CO2 in the atmosphere down to a level lower than it is today. The same campaigners that correctly picked up on the dangers of large-scale biofuels are flagging up the potential dangers of this unproven sequestration technique. I spoke to Armuth Ernsting from Biofuel Watch just before she left for Bonn. You're making a presentation at a side event at Bonn next week about your concerns about agricultural soil practices and biochar being introduced as part of the carbon trading system.
That's right. I mean, there's a major push at the moment to increase the role of agriculture in post-2012 climate change agreement. And one of the main push is for getting both biochar and so-called no-till monocultures included into carbon trading. Now, we've been particularly looking at the issue of biochar, but the issue of no-till is, you know, is equally concerning.
It might be worth explaining for people what biochar is.
Biochar is basically charcoal, which is a byproduct from a way of making bioenergy, which is called pyrolysis. What it means is exposing biomass to high temperatures with little or no oxygen, and from that you get fuel called bio-oil, which is similar to mineral oil, and syngas, which can be used to replace natural gas, and generally between 12 and 35% of charcoal. And the idea is that this can be ground down into fine-grained, almost powder charcoal and applied to soil to make the soil more fertile and in the hope that it will sequester carbon long-term.
Where did this idea originally come from? There was a very rich carbon soil in the Amazon. Is that the origin of the idea?
Well, it's true that very fertile, very high carbon soils have been found in central Amazonia, which are called Terra Preta. They were actually formed between 500 and 2,500 years ago by indigenous farmers who used very biodiverse organic residues from river sediments to kitchen waste, fish bones, animal bones, tortoise shells, etc., as well as charcoal on the soil. And the idea that's been put forward is that that can be somehow recreated by simply taking out the one element, which is a charcoal, and applying it on a very large scale. And there are very, very big concerns that things aren't quite as simple as that.
In terms of the climate, the idea is simply that you are somehow locking carbon into the soil. James Hansen talks about this at the end of his 350 paper, about this being a possible way of helping draw down carbon from the atmosphere and locking it into the soil. But you've been looking at the science that's available on this. Is it as solid as the Hansen paper might suggest?
Well, first of all, I must say that although Hansen did mention biochar in his paper in 2007, he and his assistant who co-authored the paper later also stressed that they'd really just used this as a very general example to illustrate a point about carbon sequestration, and that there were very major uncertainties still over the science surrounding biochar. Now, as far as climate relations with biochar is concerned, there's really several major issues. One is the idea behind biochar is that by biomass is somehow carbon neutral, that we just can take out vast amount of biomass from the planet without this worsening climate change. And that is simply not the case, because to get, you know, significant quantities of biomass will either have to convert cropland or ecosystems to new plantations, and that in itself will, you know, converting ecosystems will incur major, you know, major greenhouse gas emissions. And secondly, there's a question, even on the small scale, will the carbon and biochar actually remain in the soil? Will the way that it's actually put into the soil potentially worsen climate change? And could biochar lead to the soil organic carbon that is already there actually being emitted as carbon dioxide into the atmosphere? That is actually something where there's some evidence that that can very well happen.
Bearing in mind that the science does seem to be so uncertain, it seems perhaps a little premature that this is actually being rushed through, it seems, as part of the UN process.
Absolutely, it's very concerning. And just to go back to the uncertainty of science, you know, if we were dealing with medicine here and somebody trying to put out a new pharmaceutical drug, they would have to go through, you know, a series of large clinical trials before they could do that. Now, when it comes to agriculture, the equivalent of clinical trials would be field studies. When you look at biochar, you've had the first biochar company founded in 2002. So you would hope that by now we would have a series of field trials that have been going on for perhaps 7 years. In fact, there's been one single published field study that went on for around 4 years and has been abandoned. There are no other, even remotely long-term field studies. So to say that it even works at any level is completely premature. And at the same time, what will happen by incorporating this into climate agreement is creating a vast new demand for biomass, when we can see the disastrous impacts of the new demand for biofuels at the moment. So it's incurring extreme risks.
One of my concerns is that putting it into the CDM might incentivise woodland destruction because the biochar has to come from somewhere.
Absolutely, and you know, one of the ironies is that a lot of biochar advocates are saying that they can do a large-scale program without converting land. Now, that is simply not the case. The figures don't add up for that. But even if you speak of the so-called taking out forest residues, there's already a trend for bioenergy production to strip woodlands of virtually anything that's called, you know, from deadwood to shrubs, undergrowth, to, you know, even pulling out tree stumps and tree roots. That is being classed as forest residue. So both from, you know, an increased so-called demand on forest residues and the increased demand on land and converting, you know, potentially forests. Yeah, it's a big concern. And we have to remember that although nobody advocating biochar will want forests to be destroyed for this, you know, the reality is that that is also the case for biofuels. And the market realities are you create a new demand and the agricultural frontier is largely the rainforest. That will happen.
So who's pushing this stuff through the UN process at the moment? Is it science-led or is it industry-led?
Well, the main organization behind this is called the International Biochar Initiative, and it's made up of a relatively small group of industry people, some biochar startup companies, at least one biofuel company, and a number of scientists, some of whom have very close industry links, and I think there's a couple of NGOs involved in it as well. Now, what seems to have happened is that the IBI has had, gained enormous political support, and they got the United Nations Convention to Combat Desertification to endorse a paper written really by an IBI person as their submission. And this is really, you know, it's at that level that this got incorporated into the UNFCCC text, or draft negotiating text.
And what kind of chance is there to get this stopped at this point, or to at least have a slowdown so that at least might be a chance to get a bit more scientific evidence on the table so that people can make sure that this, if it's done at all, that it's done right? I understand there's a kind of sign-on text that you've been circulating that's been gathering quite a lot of support.
That's right. There's an international declaration urging caution regarding the possible scaling up of biochar and opposing the inclusion of biochar into carbon trading. That has been signed by, I think, about 156 organizations worldwide, including some quite large international networks, as well as, environmental and social justice groups. So we're really hoping that the issue is going to gain, you know, more and more attention from civil society. And it's absolutely urgent, you know, I think that people really voice serious concerns about what's being proposed in the negotiating text at the moment.
Okay, and quickly perhaps about your concerns about no-till agriculture, which again sounds a relatively benign, sustainable activity, but again, the problem seems to come in when the big corporations come in with their and try and make money out of it for their own ends.
Well, yeah, there's fundamentally two types of the idea of no-till. There's obviously the very small-scale permaculture type of not-tilling soil, but the reality when you're speaking of no-till is primarily vast monocultures of GM crops. Now, it's GM crops because, you know, what's happening is that as an alternative to ploughing, vast amounts of herbicides are being used to avoid that, with disastrous effects on soils, on communities living nearby, in terms of water pollution, also in terms of deforestation, because those types of techniques, for example, for soya, can be used in forested areas where, you know, other soya would not be commercially viable. And also of really no proven climate benefit and, you know, potentially causing climate harm.
That was Armuth Ernsting from Biofuel Watch. And James Hansen, writing in the Guardian newspaper back in March, made a clear acknowledgement of what he called the fundamental uncertainties associated with biochar. We'll be continuing to follow the Bond talks over the next couple of weeks here on the 300 to 350 show. But in the meantime, you can find references relating to Bond and to biochar up on the Climate Radio archive at www.climateradio.org. Thanks for listening.